Today is what is in the liturgical calendar is called Passion Sunday. Next week is Palm Sunday. In the world, it's called March Madness.
It's also called Geneva.
What? It is also Geneva's birthday today. She turned 30, so that means we're much older than we would like to admit. Anyway, let's pick up in our Bibles in Matthew chapter 13, where we left off last week. And we'll continue in our chronological exploration of the Bible. We're in Matthew chapter 13, verses 47 and following. And if you recall, last week we dealt with two somewhat parallel parables of the hidden treasure and the pearl of great price, and we learned more about pearls than we ever want to learn. And then we ran out of time because we had guests. And I had this section pre-prepared, which was kind of nice since I didn't have to prepare again other than reread the notes and try to remember what I learned the week before.
And then she can send
it. What's interesting is I'll just read the text here and then we'll kind of explore what's written. Verse 47. Again. By the way, notice verse 45 starts with again. 47. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a net that is thrown into the sea and gathered fish of every kind. When it was full, men drew it ashore and sat down and sorted the good into containers but threw away the bad. So it will be at the close of the age. The angels will come out and separate the evil from the righteous and throw them into the fiery furnace. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Is that an echo of another section that we studied very recently in chapter 13? But the wheat and the tares, where it says at the end of the time, they will grow together, and at harvest time I will tell the reapers to gather them, bind them, and throw them into the fire. Same idea. The same concept here is being spoken by Jesus. So let's just pull it apart a little bit. Kingdom of heaven is like a net that is thrown into the sea. The word net there is not what is typically used in describing a fisherman's net. This particular word, S-A-G-E-N-E, sagini, means a dragnet. The kind that we would typically think of in today's fishing, where you throw the big net out from behind the boat and it drags along and pulls up a whole bunch of fish and they reel it in. Normally, in the New Testament, in fact, this is the only place in the entire New Testament this word is used to describe the fisherman's net. All the other, it's a different word called amphibistron, which is the net that they throw by hand. You've seen the pastoral pictures, maybe, of the fisherman standing ankle deep or knee deep in the water, throwing his nets out, or those that are on the boats have hand-thrown nets that they throw out, let it sink, and pull it up. They don't ride around the Sea of Galilee dragging and pulling up the fish. But in this particular case, it is a different kind of dragnet, different kind of net, and very large, and kind of a new technology in some ways. But what's most interesting to me is the very last phrase of verse 47. What kind of fish do they catch?
All kinds.
All kinds. If this is a parable, which means it's reflecting or an echo of a different, it's a picture of something else, what's he talking about here?
People.
People. Yeah. Of all kinds. This is one of those hints that the gospel of Jesus' message of salvation is for everyone, not just for the Jews. It's a very subtle little kind of poke to remind these disciples that eventually at some point, and maybe they looked back on that later and went, wait a minute, that's what he was talking about. He's talking about fish of every kind. Has anybody ever seen the wonderful classic film, Finding Nemo? Remember the dragnet? Where at the very end of the film, Nemo's father is drug into the net with all the other fish and he can't get out. And if you look at that, in fact, I have the picture of that scene. It's very vivid because all the fish are scared, but they're all different kinds. All sorts of kinds. And of course, then Nemo gets very smart and he gets them all to say, swim down, and then they break the net and they're all free and happiness occurs because that's the way real life is. All sorts of fish, all kinds. In fact, in the Greek, the all kinds means all nationalities. Isn't that interesting? It is an intentional breadth of language here. I mean, you think about it, it's a strange way to talk about fish. I mean, you wouldn't talk about fish in the form of nations. You talk about fish in, you know, well, there's some trout and there's some bass and there's some salmon and there's some this and there's some all these kinds of different kinds of fish. When I grew up in Alaska, we would go fishing periodically. My dad would take us out, and I still remember catching my first fish. I was a small boy in Denali National Park, Mount McKinley National Park. Yes, it was a grayling.
It was McKinley back then.
It was McKinley, yes. Now it's Denali. And I remember catching that little fish on my thing and railing it in, and all very excited, and taking it very proudly back to the trailer. And Mom scaled it, cut it up, and that's what we ate for dinner. And I was so proud. But after a while, you got to know which kind of fish were in the stream. You could actually look and say, oh, the there's the grayling, and oh, there's the salmon, and all the different kinds. Of, you could actually see it and got to know the different kinds. Bottom line, they're all fish. They're all edible. Well, there were some we would throw back because they weren't edible. You know, that one's kind of a crusty old geezer. Throw him back. He's going to be very tasty. I don't know why I got on that rabbit trail. But anyway, it just made me think about it. Why would Jesus repeat this concept of the separating the good from the bad? He just said that earlier. He just explained it to the disciples. He's now with the disciples in the house. Verse 36, they had left the crowds and gone into the house where he's explaining the parables and he's also telling new ones. Why would he say this again?
Maybe the first time he was catering to his farmer audience and the second time he was catering to his fisherman audience.
That's a very good point. The message, however, is identical.
Right.
And you might say, well, that's just being a good teacher. Tell the same story two different ways, and then some half the class will get it one time, and the other half will get it the other, and then there's a third portion that's still kind of clueless, and I mean, you just hope they get it through osmosis someday. I'm not talking about you guys at all.
Oh no,
not at all. Please don't think I'm making that illusion. But I think it's interesting that when Jesus was asked what is the purpose of the parables up in chapter 13 verses 10 through 16. He says it's so that you can understand, but on top of that he quotes from Isaiah, which is a very apocalyptic end times judgment purpose. And then the purpose behind the wheat and the tares is that at the end of time, God, the angels, are going to separate the good from the bad. And the bad are going to be thrown into the fire. And then again, I mean, we're still in the same chapter here in Matthew. And again, he says, at the close of the age, verse 49, the angels will come out and separate the evil from the righteous, just like the fishermen do on the shore. When they pick up one fish, this is a good one. That's not any good. That's not edible. We can't do that one. And they make that separation. We tend to forget the apocalyptic, the judgment of the end times, the judgment of righteousness that is embedded in everything that Jesus does and says. We often will take these and create a nice moral of the story and forget that there is a greater purpose underneath everything that's going on. John Calvin wrote about this particular parable. In fact, I came across an interesting lecture, and it caused me to turn to Calvin this past week, because the fellow was saying, this is a rabbit trail, but it helps you understand why I turned to Calvin. He said, often when we think of John Calvin, we think of the systematic theologian, this grand thinker who set a theology that we call Calvinism, even though John Calvin would probably not abide by the Calvinism of today. It was his followers that really codified what he was saying. He said, you have to remember that the first book that John Calvin wrote was a systematic theology, was the Institutes. He wrote it very early in his career. It was a kind of a coalescing or a foundational piece based on all of this biblical teaching that he had been doing, and what he was attempting to do originally was to create a very simple way of expressing the Christian faith to those who didn't understand it, who were Catholic, okay, didn't understand that this was the gospel message. And then he later expanded that into what we have as now the Institutes. I think it was his third, he revised it three times. But as this lecturer was saying, you have to remember, however, that John Calvin was not a systematic theologian. He was a preacher. And you could take Calvin's Institutes and take those 1,000 pages, put it up on a shelf, and on this board, it would maybe take up about, 4 inches. And then you take his expositions of the Bible. I have that in a set. Genesis would start here, and Revelation would end here. He wrote, he preached over 2,000 sermons. He preached 2 times every Sunday, 3 times each week, and each sermon lasted over an hour. This man was an expositor of Scripture, and everything he did was centered on what the Scriptures had to say. And what's interesting is history focuses on his little Institutes by comparison, even though it is brilliant, forgetting that his exposition was extraordinary. So he comes to this passage, and he comes to verse 47, and he looks at verse 47, kingdom of heaven is like a net thrown into the sea and gathered fish of every kind, and then in the balance of the passage, and he says, no new instruction is given here by Christ. But what he formerly taught is confirmed by another parable, which is what I was just saying. And the confirmation is that the church of God, so long as it exists in the world, is a mixture of the good with the bad, and it is never free from stain or pollution. And yet the design of this parable is perhaps different. It may be that Christ intends not only to remove the offense which perplexes weak minds because they don't find that the world with all the purity that might be desired, but likewise to employ the influence of fear and modesty in restraining his disciples from delighting themselves with the empty title or the mere profession of faith. For my own part, I cheerfully adopt both views. Christ informs us that a mixture of the good and the bad must be patiently endured till the end of the word. Because till that time, a true and perfect restoration of the church will not take place. Again, he warns us that it is not enough, and what is more, that it is of little consequence to us to be gathered into the fold unless we are his true and chosen sheep. He's trying to say, what we have with this wheat and the tares is kind of a reminder of us that no church is perfect. And it's not going to be. How many people will say, oh, the church is full of hypocrites? Well, come join us. So are you. You know? I mean, we're all hypocrites. We have all been, we're all sinners. We're saved by grace. We understand our place. We understand that without Jesus Christ and his sacrifice and atonement, that we would be lost forever. We understand that. Years ago, Madeleine Murray O'Hare, the famous atheist who, you know, set whole sorts of things into motion, his son, William O'Hare, became a very strong Christian. And he wrote a book called The Church is Not for Perfect People. And it was dealing with this very issue, saying, look, you go into a church and like, look at that person. Oh my gosh, I mean, look what they're doing. It's like, seriously? Of course, that's why they're here. Praise God they're here. That they're hearing something, and maybe with love and concern for our fellow brethren and fellow sistren, however whatever that would mean, that we can, I don't know what the word is, that we can make some difference in their lives. Because if we don't, at the end of time, there will be a separation and they will be cast aside. This was illustrated in a another fellow's comment here. He said recently, this is less than 10 years ago, okay, at the American Baptist Convention, not the Southern Baptist Convention, the American Baptist Convention, different denomination. You remember how the American Baptists separated from the Southern Baptists? It was over slavery. Because the South wanted slaves. So the Southern Baptists were the slave owners. And the Northern Baptists were not. And they changed their name to the American Baptist. And that's how we had the separation. Southern Baptists have changed their minds. So don't worry. but that's how that started back in the 1860s. Anyway, at the American Baptist Convention, a leader from the podium said, quote, calling a person a non-Christian, any person, is like calling the Archbishop of Canterbury a non-Baptist. Everybody is within the ministry of Christ, whether or not he accepts it. Now, just follow what he's saying here. God knows the name of every sheep, not only those who bear the name of Christian. There is nothing any man can do to stop God from loving them. And you can kind of say, okay, but then he keeps going. So you see, everybody is a Christian. And the distinctions that we have, such as Christianity or Judaism or Mohammedism or Hinduism, they're just like different denominations within the Christian faith. We are all Christians. What? This is in a major Christian denominational meeting, a leader of their organization is standing up and saying, doesn't matter what you believe, we're all together in all this, we're humans, and so don't make any distinction between religions. Wow.
I think that Muslims or Jewish would have that kind of issue.
I'd say the Muslims and the Jews would have an issue with that, yes, I agree. So would the Hindus. You just kind of look at that and go, what? What are you trying to say? He's trying to say God is the God of love. He's not the God of judgment. Well, that man has not read this parable. That there is going to be a separation and a deviation, and there will be those who will be judged accordingly. Anyway.
That's like the people that say so often, and it really just bothers me, that we're all children of God. And the Bible never says that.
Yeah, it does not.
But they like to believe that.
Mm-hmm. Because then there's no judgment.
This seems to say we're all accountable to God.
They're all accountable to Him, but they're not all chosen or are not all considered children of God. They are loved by God. That's where this guy is right, up to a point. God's love is greater. But at some point, someone has to say, I trust in Jesus' name. Otherwise, Jesus saying, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. Jesus was just kidding. He was a jokester. He was on a sitcom, and it was a great line to get everybody to laugh. Or he was telling the truth. Anyway. Well, I am going to jump then in our story to the next chronological stage in our journey. Now, let me get my papers in order. Someone just messed it up, and that was me. Oh, there it is. Okay. To do this, I have to give you a handout because we are going to be jumping to Mark chapter 4. You might wonder why we're jumping to Mark for the first time because I've been in Matthew or Luke. Partly because in this particular section, if you'll see at the top of your page, the Matthew portion is in chapter 8. But I thought we were in chapter 13. Now remember, Matthew is not written necessarily in chronological order. Matthew's gospel often will take a thematic approach in his presentation of the material. You have Luke is a little more chronological, but Mark, of all of them, is probably the most chronological. But because it's such a short book and so much of it is repeated in the other Gospels, we have not used Mark as our key place. And there are many, many stories or many incidents that are not recalled in Mark. But in this particular case, if you were to look at Mark in your Bible, you will see that the previous section is on parables. So they're teaching parables, and the next section in chapter 4 of Mark is this particular incident of Jesus in the boat with the disciples and the storm coming up. So let me just read the section, and if you recall how I retyped what one of the commentators does. We have the Mark text, and then in brackets, we will have, for instance, you see on the first line there, when Jesus saw the crowds around him, MT, that is from Matthew. And where it has LK, that part is from Luke. So we'll read it together, then we'll come back through and break it apart. That day, when evening came, when Jesus saw the crowds around him, he said to his disciples, "Let's go over to the other side." Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with him. Without warning, a furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped, and they were in great danger. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him, "Lord," or in Luke, "Master, Master," or in Mark, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Be quiet, be still." Then the wind died down and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" They were terrified and in fear and amazement asked each other, "Who is this? What kind of man is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him." Fascinating. Fascinating passage. Now, if we want to put this in our chronological order, we had Jesus speaking in parables. Then they went to the house where they probably had lunch or dinner or snack or whatever, and he's talking some more. They were trying to get away from the crowds. And for some reason, we're not sure why, the theory is that the crowds figured out they were at the house. And the crowds all begin to gather in the courtyard and gather around, and there was no peace. And for some reason, Jesus says, let's go to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. You may think, so what's the big deal? Well, remember our nice little Sea of Galilee, down to the Dead Sea. This little guy is 27 miles. I have this right? Yes. 27 miles long and 7.5 miles wide. 7.5 miles. That is the distance between Camelback and, let's see, Camelback, Bethany Home, Glendale, Northern.
Dunlap.
Dunlap, Peoria. Okay, it'd be the distance from Christown to Metro Center. Okay, that's a little short, but you get the idea.
Can you go south instead?
Oh, south? Okay, let's go from Glendale or Lincoln, Camelback, Indian School, Thomas McDowell. So you see, it would be distance basically from here to the baseball stadium. Okay. That's not a short road. It's not a really very short trip in a rowboat.
Let's go on over the other side.
Let's go to the east side, the west side. Oh, doggone it.
Well, hey, we're here. Let's go over there. Come on, guys.
How far is 5 miles going west?
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to get in a car and drive it. It's another thing to bicycle. It's another thing to
row. Another thing to row it or try to set up your sails. And let it, you're not moving very fast. So this is something that's going to take a couple hours, at least. And more than likely, they're up here in Capernaum. And we know where they ended up, because the next scene is the Gerasim demoniac. Because when they get out of the boat, he's dealing with a demon who comes out and talks to them. So they're all down over in here. So this is their trip. All right, you with me? Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Galilee is 650 feet below sea level. Below. On this side, over here, the upper, let's see, that would be the northeast corner, are the Golan Heights. The famous Golan Heights of the Six-Day War and the whole problem with Syria and Lebanon and all that. The top of the Golan Heights is 2,000 feet above sea level. So you have, and there's of course hills all around here, and over in this area is Mount Hermon, which is at 9,000 feet. The wind comes off the top of these mountains and then drops. And whips up the sea very quickly. Because some people would, I've mentioned this before, that the Sea of Galilee is more like a little lake. It's not a sea. It's not like the Mediterranean Sea. Something that's 27 miles by 8 miles, that's a lake. Okay, come on. You know, but it was called a sea because there's not a lot of water in the area and they got excited. It's a sea. It's a sea of water. Anyway, or look, I see water. Anyway, boy, I was waiting all afternoon to get that one in. Anyway, it is 140 feet deep at its lowest point. So this is not a shallow lake. This is a dangerous lake. When we were out with the game group, what was the lake we were on? I can't remember.
Lake Pleasant,
okay. Lake Pleasant, we were up, and at one point, we were out with one of our friends on their boat, and he drops the anchor because we want to not drift. He wanted to try to secure. And he dropped his anchor to about 40 feet. And we had a tough time finding anything to grab a hold of. He figured that the depth there was probably closer to 60. And anything he was grabbing was probably an old tree that it was hooking onto. This is twice that deep. There are more than likely an awful lot of shipwrecks at the bottom of the Sea of Galilee. Many, many billions of years ago when I was in college and I went to the to Israel on a trip, we stayed the night in Tiberias, which is about right here, in a hotel. And I remember as the sun was setting, I looked out from the balcony of the hotel room that we were at, facing the Sea of Galilee. And I mean, there were white caps on that sea. It was really rough. And there were no boats out there at all. And I was stunned. I thought, my gosh, this is supposed to be so pastoral. And this is dangerous. I mean, this is not a normal, you just don't go out in something like that. So the next day, we get up because we're supposed to be going out in the Sea of Galilee as part of our excursion to travel around a little bit. And the sea was like glass. It was like a mirror. No movement, not a ripple in the water. All sorts of boats everywhere and everything else. So I asked the guide, I said, okay, last night was a bad day. He goes, oh, yesterday was a bad day. Not a single fisherman went out and worked yesterday. No one did. The sea was too rough. I said, but today is gorgeous. He goes, oh, it's normal around here. I said, and the thing is, he says, you know that story in the New Testament where the wind came up suddenly and Jesus, you know, was asleep in the boat? He says, it's very possible that we could be out this afternoon and the wind comes up and we got to get out. We got to race for the shore. So I'm just warning everybody that enjoy it while you can, because the wind can change the nature of this sea very quickly and it can get very dangerous very fast. But here's the thing. Who's in the boat with Jesus?
Disciples.
And the disciples were mostly
fishermen.
They know the Sea of Galilee. They know how it works. I mean, you know, they deal with this every day. And it says in verse 38, the disciples woke him and said, don't you care that we drown? They're in great danger. This had to be really severe. Not just, oh, the boat's a little bouncy, you know. I'm not feeling good, you know. This is not happy. No, they say that in the most extreme, and this is the writings about the Sea of Galilee and others, at its worst, the waves can get 10 to 12 feet high on the Sea of Galilee. The ceiling, see that? Fingertip is 8 feet. So imagine a wave as high as the ceiling coming at you. And your boat is not a cruise ship. You are in a little tiny, wooden thing that is already loaded down with 13 men. So we have 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14 of us in the room right now. Let's all get in a boat. And let's get in a boat that's about 7 feet wide, so that would be from here to the first row, and about 20 feet long, so that would be from that chair to that chair. So let's all gather. I'm being facetious here, but all gather and let's all sit in this boat and let's make sure we act like we're all light and we're on air. But no, we're settling down, so the gunwales of the boat are getting closer and closer to this water. And now a 10-foot wave is coming at us. I would be terrified. Now those, and I was hoping Wayne would be here, because Wayne has been a fisherman and he's dealt with seas like this, but has anybody been in a furious squall in a boat? Anybody? Anyone had this experience? I did. This is in Alaska, again, as a kid. There is a ferry trip you can take from a little town called Whittier. The only way to get to Whittier is by train through a tunnel. You go through the tunnel, put your car on a ferry, and then you go through all these passages. This is up near Anchorage, not down near Juneau. And you go through all these passages with the glaciers and just an incredible thing. And then you get to Valdez and then you get off. And what we did is we then got off and then drove back. So it was like a day, 2 day trip kind of thing. Well, we got out into the open water and the seas got really rough. I mean, everybody was throwing up. I mean, it was really bad. And I'm sitting here watching all of this. I'm not sick. I'm feeling queasy. My dad had a constitution of a horse. I mean, he didn't get sick for nothing. And he's just kind of looking around going, what's wrong with these people? And he's looking at me and I'm feeling a little green and I'm not feeling that well. And he says, let's just take a step outside. And of course the brisk air kind of pops you awake and it helps you a little bit. And he goes, well, where's Grandma Flurry? Now Grandma Flurry was a kind of our adopted grandma. She had befriended my dad when he was in the army and they became part of our family. And he found her and he said, son, come with me, you gotta see this. We go down into the ferry to the basement, the floor where the cars are. Now, the front of the ferry has the drawbridge kind of thing, but this is just lifted up slightly. So it's open to the sea. All the cars are chained to the ferry. And the cars are because of the suspension and the water. I mean, you're looking around and these cars are ready to jump. And on the very front of that boat, with the spray coming up there, is Grandma Flurry. Standing there with her hands on her hips and her feet spread and going, I love this! She had no fear at all. And I'm kind of looking, you know, and I'm looking around. And she goes, come here, son, you know. And I'm kind of edging my way. She just grabs my arm and says, this is great. And I'm going, but we're going to drown. He goes, we're fine. I wanted her on this boat. The captain of the ship was probably not afraid. The workers on that ship were probably not afraid. Grandma Flurry wasn't afraid. So if they were people who would normally know when a boat was in danger, that's when you get afraid. That's why they say if you're on an airplane and things start making weird noises, look at the flight attendants. And the flight attendants says their pupils are dilated and they begin to get frantic, it's time to be a little afraid. But normally they're just like, no big deal, this happens all the time. I tell that whole story to say, these disciples were afraid. They were afraid for their life. And they turn, and there's Jesus snoring in the other boat. Completely unafraid. For one thing, how did he sleep through that? Well, some were saying, well, he's, you know, been working all day. I mean, it's been a long day. Do you realize that in all of the New Testament, this is the only place we see Jesus asleep? Finally caught up to him. He's been going 24/7 for weeks. But seriously, think about that. In all the other passages, in all the other incidents, in all everything else in the New Testament, we do not ever see him asleep. You know that he did. You know that he went away to pray, or that he would rest, or he would do this or that. but we actually see it described here as being asleep. He is not afraid of this furious squall. In Matthew, the word storm or furious squall is the Greek word seismos, which means earthquake. It's a little earthquake. In Mark and Luke, it's a completely different word.
It is L-A-I-L-A-P-S. Lailapis,
which means hurricane. Or whirlwind. Can be used either way. In fact, in Greek literature, it's used both ways. In the Greek Old Testament, the Septuagint, when it talks about the storm that overwhelmed Jonah's boat, they use the Greek word liopis. It is a whirlwind, it is a storm, a massive storm, and in that case, it was so bad that they threw Jonah off the side to try to save the rest of them. And that's Jonah screaming right now, I don't want to go. That's loud. Okay.
Jeff is over there.
Oh, that's Jeff screaming. He wants out. He doesn't want to be volunteering anymore. So we have something here that is very dangerous. It's described in pretty violent terms. The other thing is, it's very rare for these storms to happen at night. Think about our, oh, we were figuring that was him. That was Jeff screaming. Yeah, it was. Yeah. No! As 17 kids are pummeling him over in the corner. Anyway, you think about our desert weather. When do the desert storms happen? Do they happen at night?
No.
Yeah. No.
Sunset.
Sunset. Exactly, because the weather changes, the winds come up out of the desert, pick up all the dirt, and throw it at us.
People are going home from work.
You know, that's what's causing it all. People would stay at work and nothing would happen, right? You don't find it happen very often in the mornings. There is a kind of a meteorological reasoning behind it that. So the storms that will be whipping up at the Sea of Galilee are not going to happen very often at night. Now, we do have storms at night. They're just not as often. And when they do happen at night, often they can be pretty strong. Like the one that uprooted the tree in our backyard in 2008. That was it. That was after dark. So it can happen. It's just rare. Jesus is asleep. And when he wakes, they wake him up. He rebukes the wind and says to the waves, quiet, be still. And the wind dies down and is completely calm. It's very interesting. If you have your Bibles open in Mark, and you look at Mark chapter 1, verse 25, Jesus is dealing with a man with an unclean spirit. And in verse 25, Jesus rebuked him, same word that we have of Jesus rebuking the storm, and says to the man, the demon inside the man, be quiet. Same words. The identical phraseology we find in Jesus dealing with the storm. This has caused some scholars to say that this whole storm was a demonic attack. I think that's stretching the incident a little beyond where I think Jesus intended it to be. Because if you think about, in some ways, this is almost a parable in action. Because you can kind of look back and apply all sorts of incredible allegorical, metaphorical, all sorts of applications to this incident And the fact that it's in all three Gospels meant that there were eyewitnesses there. More than likely, Matthew was there. He was one of the 12. And if Peter's source, I'm sorry, if Mark's source for his stories were Peter, Peter was there too. And Luke did his research. He interviewed a whole bunch of people to make his stories. He would be interviewing and talking to those that were there. Some were probably closer to the end of the boat where Jesus was, and some were at the other crying out, going, "Oh my gosh, we're going to die." Which is what would help understand why there's some variation between what happens. Because in Matthew, the reason I'm saying all this, in Matthew, on our page, what you see in verse 40 comes before verse 39. In Matthew, Jesus wakes up, turns to the disciples and goes, "Why are you guys afraid?" And then he rebukes the storm and the sea. But in Mark and Luke, he wakes up, rebukes the storm and the sea, and then turns to the disciples and said, "Why are you afraid?" Isn't that interesting?
Maybe he's like, "Hold on, I can't hear you."
Maybe. There are those, I mean, this has caused no measure of controversy among those trying to correlate the stories. And that's where one of the writers said what I just said to you. He says, well, you've got three possible variations of the same story, and they're all remembering it. It's not like they pulled out their digital recorder and knew exactly when happened and what was said, but it was all said in the context of the incident. I have read complete sermons which make a big deal of the fact that Jesus rebuked the disciples first and then rebuked the storm. Problem is that isn't what happens in Mark and Luke. So makes for an interesting sermon, but it may not be exactly the way it happened. I think it's more important that rather than dealing with the chronology of the event within the event, we look at what is said inside the event itself. He calms the storm. Now, it's interesting. If you take a bathtub full of water and you take your arm and you start stirring up the water back and forth and back and forth, you'll get up with big waves, right? Some bigger, they'll even splash out of the tub. Then stop. Pull your arm out. It takes a while for the water to completely get still again, doesn't it? Because it's still got the motion inside. The physics are there. Just back and forth and back and forth. You look at this text, it says the wind died down and it was completely calm. Sea of Galilee is a big bathtub. Now granted, by comparison, it may have felt calm. But that quickly, we have seen storms pass quickly in our lifetime where you're in, you know, it's all rainy and scary and everything, and suddenly the sun is shining on you while it's still raining. It's the most bizarre feeling in the world. And yet in this particular case, it shows the incredible and extraordinary power of Jesus over nature. It's the first time you have Jesus interacting in a miraculous way with nature like this. I mean, he's dealt with inanimate objects before. Someone tried to made the comment, "This is the first miracle with inanimate objects." I went, "He changed the water into wine. Did you forget?" I mean, that was a while ago. Didn't think about that one when you wrote your commentary. But anyway, in Colossians chapter 1, I'll just read it to you. Colossians 1, 16 and 17. "For by him," Jesus, "all things are created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things are created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together." Hebrews 1:3, He, Jesus, is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of His nature, and He upholds the universe by the word of His power. This is the one who said to the storm, "Be quiet." And it was. Then He turns to these disciples. One of those grand moments that, you know, I'm just glad I wasn't there, because I would have felt really small. Where He says, "Why are you so afraid? Where's your faith? Seriously." And it's not the only time He says this. The idea of a rebuke, if you want to call it that, for a lack of faith is found in Mark 7, Mark 8, and Mark 9. It's also found in Matthew 6, Matthew 14, Matthew 16, and Luke 12. It's not the only time Jesus says this. We're going to run into this statement frequently. He has started talking in parables. Then He says to them, "I'm speaking so that you might understand." And then at the end, in fact, I skipped that section in Matthew 13, He says when He's done, "So do you understand what I'm talking about?" And they go, "Yes, we do." Then they get in the boat. And they get afraid, and He says, you almost want to, you know, it's almost like He said, "I thought you said you understood who I am." Now, before we get too, you know, whack on these poor guys, they did wake Him up. There was that element of, He can do something about this. Don't you think? I mean, there is that element there. But still, Jesus saw at their very core, they did not trust fully in Him, in their belief in who He is and their security. I don't know what this has to do with it, but I just thought it was fun. The story of in 1951, Red Skelton and a party of his friends were flying to Europe to appear in London Palladium. And as they were flying over the Swiss Alps on their way, three of the four engines in the airplane failed. And the situation was not good. The passengers all began to pray. Skelton stood up and went into his comic routine to distract everyone. So imagine Red Skelton start doing all of his pantomiming and everything. As the plane is getting lower and lower, like it looks like they're going to run into the mountains. And at the last moment, pilots saw a large field on the slopes and he made a perfect landing. And Skelton spoke up into the relieved silence, saying, "Now, ladies and gentlemen, you may return to the evil habits you gave up 20 minutes ago." There is that element of what happens when you're in mortal danger. You start thinking and being, "Oh my gosh, you know, I did all these bad things and I repent." And the point is, you can almost see Jesus saying, "It took that for you to think." When storms come, in fact, one guy wrote, he says, you're in one of three places right now in your life. You're either in the midst of a storm of any kind, you're coming out of one, or you're about to go into one. It's just the way life is. It's just how it happens. And it can come up at the last minute. It can come suddenly. It can be long and drawn out. See, the older we get, the more we realize this, and it's still not easy. And there's those moments where we doubt, we have fears. Well, Charles Spurgeon was relating to this. He said, "He brought you on this stormy sea, I want to pause there. Jesus knew the weather report. And he still got in the boat. It's like he knew this was going to happen. This was his opportunity to have another teaching moment. He bade you to take the ship, and he knew about the storm coming on. Do you think because of your present experience that he doesn't love you anymore? And there is that moment where Spurgeon sitting there, it's leaving that question mark, and I go, how often when things get difficult and dark that I think I'm alone in this? You dare to utter such a calumny? Look back at your past life and see how patiently he has borne with you. Your slowness in learning has not made your divine teacher angry. He has still gone on teaching you. Do you remember when he first called you by his grace and what you were when he called you? Do you not recollect what you have been since he called you? Yet he still continues to love you and has not cast you away. Look back, I pray you, upon the many times in which he has appeared for you, bringing you through every severe trial and sustaining you under heavy burdens. After all this, do you mistrust him? How can you do this? Will you imitate the language of the unbelieving who say, it's because there's no graves on the shore that Jesus brought us out into this stormy sea? Do you suspect that he has brought you thus far, encouraging you with hope, allaying your fears, supplying your necessity, that today he will overwhelm you with disappointment? No. Each believer can confidently sing, can he have taught me to trust in his name and thus far have brought me to put me to shame? So well stated. There are times where we just feel like it's difficult, it's too hard, and yet he gives us peace. He calms that storm. He calms the storm whether we recognize it or not. Always does. He is always there waiting for us to just ask. And then he turns to us and goes, you didn't have to worry. I was here the whole time. I think we're at the end of our time, so I'll close. Lord, thank you for our moments together. There's so much more in this passage that I barely touch on it. I feel there are times where we need to come back to these passages a second week, a third week, and a fourth week, and just to hear the message over and over and over again so that we just drum it into our souls, into our minds, so that we understand truly who you are and what you do for us. In the midst of great storms, in the midst of great trials and troubles, anxiety, tension, doubt, you are there. And you will calm that storm just by your word every single time. Help us to believe that, to remember it, and embrace it. In Jesus' name, amen.